Normoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we continue our close look at the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. Countries around the world have been easing restrictions imposed to stop the spread of COVID-19. Many governments are worried about the impact of lockdown measures on the economy. Experiences with the spread of COVID-19 have been different across the continent, with South Africa as the continent's hotspot. Uganda has begun to ease restrictions, along with the tropical island of Mauritius. The island has reported no new cases for more than a week. Health ministers from three different nations met to speak about the unique challenges this global pandemic poses to them.
The coronavirus, medical experts like to say, doesn't care about borders or language or any of the cultural aspects of humanity. Like viruses the world over, it just sees targets. But since the virus appeared on the African continent some 3 months ago, it has taken a different course in different countries. The continent recently reported 100,000 positive cases, but they're spread unevenly. South Africa leads the continent with more than 25,000 cases and rapid growth, whereas the small tropical island of Mauritius hasn't seen a new case of local transmission in more than a month. Meanwhile, countries such as Rwanda and Uganda that have previously sparred with epidemics have reported cases in the hundreds, but no deaths. Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, says the organization is training more than 10,000 health workers in an attempt to decentralize their response to deal with these different realities.
Most countries still have fewer than 1,000 reported cases. This means that as governments ease lockdowns and other social measures, it's important that the strong public health measures are in place all over the territories, not just in the capital cities, that communities are empowered and enabled to take preventive actions, and that we continue working on strengthening health systems and delivering essential services to people.
In Mauritius, the nation's Minister of Health and Wellness, Dr. Kailash Kumar Singh Jagutpal, said preparation was key to the nation's response and its apparent success in containing the virus.
Mauritius registered the first cases of COVID-19 in March. Our monitoring and preparedness action plan was in place already since mid of January. The Mauritian Prime Minister himself chairs a high-level committee on a daily basis. This allows the government to have daily updates on the evolution of the pandemic and implementation measures.
Despite seeing rapidly growing clusters of the outbreak, South Africa recently announced a new approach. Houses of worship will now be allowed to reopen, with limited congregation sizes and precautions. That, Health Minister Dr. Zweli Mkhize explained, is part of the strategy. Deputize trusted institutions, like churches, to teach South Africans how to live with the virus in the long term.
It has become clear that we are likely to have this pandemic for more than a year, maybe even to 2 years. And therefore, it is important for us to understand that there is a degree of easing. And in this process is to begin to motivate for every part of our society to focus on social and behavioral change.
And in the East African nation of Uganda, which has yet to report any deaths amid its fewer than 300 cases, Health Minister Dr. Jane Acheng said the health system was already well fortified by other lethal epidemics.
Uganda has had opportunity to have several outbreaks. From the year 2000 to date, at least we have had over 6 Ebola outbreaks and about 5 Marburg outbreaks and several other outbreaks. And these outbreaks have given us opportunity to build capacity, but also to build systems in place which can easily be activated to respond to epidemics as they are occurring.
Moeti, who said that cases in Africa remain lower than in other parts of the world, said one thing holds true across this continent. The virus doesn't let its guard down in its quest to survive. And so she said, we shouldn't either. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Mauritius, considered one of Africa's most successful countries in combating the new coronavirus, lifted some restrictions this past weekend. Observers say the government of Mauritius responded early to the coronavirus pandemic with stringent lockdown measures and saw a drastic reduction in new cases. I spoke to Amina Gourib Fahim, former president of Mauritius, about the country's approach to fighting the virus and lessons learned. Take a listen.
Your Excellency Amina Gourib Fahim, thank you so much for joining us on Voice of America.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start on the news of today, if you will, COVID-19, the pandemic. Yes. Mauritius has been cited as an example of success stories. A few months ago, WHO had projected that the country would be one of the most affected on the continent. What can you tell us about the Mauritius experience with regard to fighting COVID-19?
We've had 10 deaths, actually. We've had 332 cases, most of them recovered. So for the past 28 days, that is the cycle of 2 times 14, we haven't recorded any new cases. And I think, we just adhered to what has been prescribed internationally when the first cases were detected early March. And there has been lockdown of the airspace, and the people coming in, they were quarantined. And because we have a free healthcare, so access to medicine was not an issue. And so we have adhered to the best practices all along. And people also have been quite disciplined. I must say that, initially I must confess it was not easy because all of a sudden your life has been completely transformed. And but at the end, just people got to realize that we are talking about a new beast for which there was no prescribed drug as such, and people had to cooperate.
So lockdown has been lifted. Now people will go about their business as usual. But you said something important. You said people were disciplined. So when we look to governments, when we look to leaders to take care of these issues, there is a role that communities, people, individuals must play to make sure that these measures can be implemented properly. Can you comment on that?
Yes, it works both ways. In as much as government have also, they have a responsibility of providing very clear guidelines and practical guidelines as well, because sometimes guidelines are, given, they are literally, very good academically, but when put into practice, it can be chaotic. And when these guidelines have been given in very clear and certain terms, and people have listened to it, and when people have not listened to it, I think the police has been there to actually ensure law and order and make sure that the guidelines were respected. So it was a kind of triangular kind of approach, and it was very much the carrot and the stick approach, which meant that, over the weekend, we've had lockdown lifted maybe earlier than we thought. So as of today, we can say that, we've got our freedom back.
So what would you say are the lessons learned from Mauritius for Africa and the world, really?
First of all, I must say that, across Africa, the projections that had been made initially, they haven't materialized, which is a very, very good sign. Is it because Africans are getting more resistant? Because, Africa, we've had our dose of infectious diseases and pandemics, and we've had Ebola, we've had Zika, we had all sorts of these crises. Is it that? Or is it genetically there are issues there that need to be looked into? Is it the discipline that have been maintained by the government in place? Is it the discipline that have been adhered to by the public? I mean, I think it's a combination of all these together. And hopefully, let us take lessons out of this that we show more preparedness. Because initially, I must say, my concerns when we were listening to what the WHO was saying in terms of social distancing, in terms of washing your hands, and I was very, very worried because in some parts of Africa, this is impossible. I mean, how can you do social distancing when so many people are living in one room, when water is a luxury, and where even soap and running water cannot be found? But
you know, just again, keep fingers crossed that this will be okay for the rest of the continent. And very soon the COVID will be a very bad memory.
Some people have said that the country took very drastic measures to ensure that this type of success happened in the end. People were locked down, and then the economic impact has been felt in many other countries. What can you tell us in terms of economic recovery?
Well, you know, as you know, as the people know, that Mauritius, we depend a lot on tourism, right? And tourism directly brings about 9% to the GDP. But if you look at the aggregate industries around, we are talking about 23%. So that has been more or less been wiped off for this year. And then we've looked at, you know, the other sectors, agriculture, you know, all the other sectors, which unfortunately haven't fared too well. And we have concern about what form this recovery will take. I mean, government is already voting a kind of economic package to save the industry. But, you know, how can we save tourism right now when the rest of the world is still in lockdown? And there is no certainty. And in fact, some of the major operators are saying that tourism, as we've known it, will not happen again. Or if we have some form of tourism, it will not be till mid-2021. So what do we do for this financial year? This is a very, very big concern for us. And notwithstanding the fact that because of COVID, other sectors have been impacted. If you look at the health sector, obviously, education, because again, there has not been sufficient preparedness in terms of online learning. It demands a whole new set of skills and, of course, a whole new set of infrastructure. And again, woefully, it shows the unpreparedness of many African countries, including ours, in terms of online learning. However, there are some green shoots which we see emerging, and that is, you know, the digital economy is flagged to be the next big winner. We have seen deliveries, for example, home deliveries, food packs, all this happening during the past 2.5 months. So I think these are green shoots that we need to explore further. But fortunately, we had invested already in the space of IT, so we do have reasonable bandwidth. But of course, we need to improve on all these green shoots so that this becomes a new pillar for the economy in the next months and years to come.
It's time for a short break. When we return, we'll have part two of my exclusive interview with Her Excellency Amina Gourib Fahim, former president of Mauritius. When we return, we'll look at the role of African traditional medicine. Don't go away. Welcome back to Health Chat. If you're just joining us, tonight we are discussing the COVID-19 pandemic. And coming up now is part two of my exclusive interview with former president of Mauritius, Amina Gourib Fahim, who is also a biodiversity scientist. We discuss now the challenges faced by African traditional medicine and what it will take for its proper recognition.
Let's talk about something else that you're very passionate about, which is digging into Africa's herbs to find potential cures and medicine. Talk to us about this passion of yours and why it is important to look into African traditional herbs, especially with an experience that we are all witnessing when we look at what's happening with Madagascar and COVID organics resorting to Artemisia. What is the role that Africa can play, or what role African herbs can play in the big picture of medicine, or in particular with COVID-19?
You know, up until 1945, the Second World War, the entire world, we were being treated with herbs. Why I mentioned the milestone of 1945, this is when we got the antibiotics. We start with penicillin, and since then we have gone all the way into synthetic medications. Now, while I would be a big proponent of going to the doctors and getting an antibiotic, a shot of medicine that will cure me immediately if I have a headache or stomachache or whatever it is, the chronic ailments, they still require long-term treatment based on herbal medicine. Traditional medicine has still its value in the treatment of chronic ailments. And here I look at, for example, skin ailments like psoriasis. I think of diabetes and all these chronic diseases or conditions that require things other than drugs. Now, so what happened is that as the years went by, we have started marginalizing the herbal medicine because we have focused mainly on synthetic antibiotic and all the rest of it. Now, at the end of the day, the scientist proposing these new cures as modern medicine, they still have to go back to nature to look for that single molecule. So they still have to go back. And of course, traditional medicine is a shortcut because people have been taking it for generations. The issue of toxicity has been looked into. So they have a law which is there, which needs to be probed into. Now, if you look at the contribution of the entire world, the developing world, to the world of medicine, we find that they have made phenomenal contribution, but Africa is still lagging behind. And I put this down to two main reasons. First reason is that we haven't really documented our own traditional knowledge, because the documentation, or rather the transmission in Africa, has been oral. And every time an elderly passes on, we have lost a library. India and China, for example, they have taken that very seriously. They have documented, and China did it so well that in 2015, the herbal medicine that gave artemisinin has been rewarded with a Nobel, right? And now India, with Ayurvedic medicine, they are now contributing other molecules towards ailments like the COVID, for example. Now, to come back again to the artemisinin, in 2003, when they had SARS, it has been reported in the literature that to treat SARS, extracts of artemisinin had been used for the treatment of SARS, and SARS is a corona. So now we have another coronavirus, so I could extrapolate from there that there may be something in this Artemisia annua, which gives artemisinin, which grows in Madagascar, that is providing solutions. But of course, we don't know because the tests are ongoing for COVID, for the Tamba of Sibiu, as the president calls it. And so who knows, in about 3 weeks' time, this is what the WHO is saying, they need to test the COVID organic. And hopefully they'll come up with something, but it is critical that we safeguard not just the biodiversity, the plants, but also the traditional knowledge that goes with it. And this has been part of my work as a researcher, is to document precisely these traditional knowledge, and I have published the database, which is now in the public domain.
Given the controversy around COVID organics, it begs the question, do herbal and traditional medicine undergo the same rigorous process as conventional medicine?
There has been, of course, many conventions which have looked into traditional knowledge, traditional medicine, and there is what increasingly we refer to as reverse pharmacology. I'll just explain. When we develop a medicine, modern medicine for a plant, usually we take the plant, we take the extract, we isolate the one molecule, and this is the silver bullet which actually goes into the formulation of the drug. But increasingly, for herbal medicine, we adopt what is known as reverse pharmacology, that we observe what is happening on the ground, and then we take the recipe and we test it in the lab. And this is what is the procedure which is accepted and acceptable for herbal medicine, because as I said, they have been used, they are giving results. So instead of reinventing the wheel, if I may say so, is to take that recipe back, retest its activity exactly the same way that people have been using it, and then test the dosage, and then test the toxicity. I think this is the approach that the Chinese are doing, and they're doing it so well, because China has given the same status as allopathic medicine to Chinese herbal medicine. And that's a very, very powerful message to the world of how seriously they take the traditional medicine. Now, why it's important, again, to add value to this traditional knowledge, because A, they give new molecule for medicine, and B, they are an accepted and acceptable form, which we have taken for so many years by our grandmothers have been giving us these recipes. And it is socially and is culturally accepted to be treated by herbal medicine. So I think the procedure are different.
What will it take for African traditional medicine to get recognition and respect, if you will, that Chinese medicine receive at the international level?
We start with ourselves. We start recognizing, we start accepting our own heritage. We start accepting our own traditions. We start accepting our own medicine as has been given to us by our grandmothers and which work. And in fact, if you look at even WHO figures, they will tell you that 80% of the world's population still depend on herbal medicine for their primary healthcare. Now, if you look at it from the economic point of view, it's a huge business which can emerge out of this, because not only is it cheap, it's accessible, it's affordable, and I will add further, it works.
Now, I cannot let you go without talking about leadership, of course. You were, as I mentioned earlier, you were the president of Mauritius from 2015-2018, many milestones, first female, first Muslim on the continent, first female in your country. Talk to us about what you took away from that experience as a leader, as a female leader, but also as an African leader.
First of all, I must say that I have been an accidental president, because I have been a scientist all my life, but I landed in that post totally by accident, because, you know, I just took a risk. I took a huge risk to throw my hat in 2014, and lo and behold, the party was elected, and that made me president. But having said this, it was a huge privilege to serve my country and to serve my continent. But it's a position, first of all, it's very lonely. And it's a position where you have to be very, very careful into what you say, what you do, and all that goes with it. But having said this, it's a position that matters. It's a position that matters for women, if only we make up the numbers. It's important to have the numbers. And more importantly, it's critical for my little girl growing up, either my daughter or that little girl growing up in my village, to say, yes, it's possible to be out there. The role modeling is very, very important. And having said this, having a woman at political power position is very, very key, because I keep making the difference between leadership and power positions. We are all in leadership position. If you're driving our own business, if you're driving our own enterprise, we are leaders. But we need women in power, because this is where the decisions get taken. This is where the change can happen for precisely the laws which will favor women. And these decisions take a different form when a woman is on board. That's why I say again, very cliche, if there is no place for you at the table, bring your chair and sit at the table. Because if you're not sitting at the table, you are going to be part of the menu. And this is not what we want. So we need more women out there. But having said this, we need to rise as a community of women, because unfortunately, women tend to disparage women more. And that's a shameful part.
Very shameful indeed. So as we teach young women in Africa about leadership, about position of power, what do you think can be taught to young women as they aspire to position of power, drawing from your experience?
First of all, I think getting a good education is key. And this is, again, which is missing in many parts of Africa, many parts of the world, for that matter. Women are still denied. Girls are still denied access to school. When they are in that school, we need to ensure that we address two issues. We address stereotype, and we also address the entire issue of, stereotype and also structures. So the structure is whether the girl is comfortable, the girl is being taught the right thing. She's not being told that science, for example, is not for her. So we need to look at the structure. And we need to do away with the stereotype, the stereotypes in books, where some jobs are reserved for men, some jobs are reserved for girls or for women. When she's at home, the family also has to tell her that the chores at home are for her brother as well as for her. So these are changes which are very subtle. And this way, the girl confidence will rise. And this is what happened to me when I was growing up, because my father never made the difference between myself and my brother. We were given equal opportunities, and he was always encouraging me to go along and to have confidence, to believe in myself. So this is something I said to women, believe in yourself, learn to take risk. It is not taught in school. It is not taught in business school, but we need to take a calculated risk, and that will come when you have that gut reaction that what you're going to do is the right step. So we need to take that opportunity and seize on it and move forward. And so again, having the right mentor, having the right role model, they are very, very important. But when she's out there, let's say she wants to become an entrepreneur, she needs to have the law to be on her side. She can open a bank account. She can have access to capital. The laws will be on her side, moving with her. She doesn't have to go against the grain all the time. So, but these are conditions which can be laid out by women like myself of a certain generation to ensure that we pull them along as we rise together. So we need to instill that self-confidence, and that woman must be able to say to herself and to others, we are beautiful, we are capable, we are smart, and we can do it.
And when we teach the young girl about becoming a leader and preparing her for positions of power, what do we teach her brother?
We teach her brother to learn to respect the woman. And that's something which starts at a very young age. As I said, make the boy, you know, do the dishes, make the boy clean his room. It's not for the mother and for the daughter. And also don't tell the family when we're talking, oh, you're crying like a girl. Oh, for goodness sake, men cry as well, right? So these are narratives that we have to change subtly. So, and I keep saying all the time, you know, change will happen one family at a time. It will happen when a brother, that uncle, that grandfather, the father become cheerleader of that girl. And this is the way that we will be able to change things, subtly but surely. It has to be done, because the African continent, the economies of the African continent will not be able to function at full speed if we are going to keep on excluding 52% of the population.
So finally, what is your message to the African youth?
African youth, just go out there and just do it and try it. Take a risk. You will fall, but you will rise, and never give up hope. Hope is allowed. Hope is there. And we have to seize the opportunity, and we have to speak to government to invest in the youth. And I use the word investment because anything that we're going to spend on that youth is not an expense, it's an investment. So let us learn, and I keep saying, I will say it and I will say it again, the future of Africa is in the minds of the young people. It is not in the minds.
Mm. That's a good one. Your Excellency Amina Gourib Fahim, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. As I say, we are free now. We can walk around.
And that's our show for today. We thank our guest, Her Excellency Amina Gourib Fahim, former president of Mauritius and biodiversity engineer. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat. I'm your host, Lenore Modou in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Hi there, this is Lori London, host of VOA's International Edition. Join me weekdays at 3:30, 4:30, and 5:30 UTC for the big stories facing our world. From Africa to the Americas and every place in between, we've got you covered with the latest news and information. You'll also hear from real people and real communities across the globe and get a daily dose of what's happening in music and entertainment on The Voice of America.
Sports fans have a lot to hear each day on VOA. Listen to the sunny side of sports for the latest from Africa, the United States, and around the world.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Great show, bro.
Find the sunny side of sports on the radio, online, and as a podcast.
This is Sunny Side of Sports
right here on The Voice of America.
I get it.
VOA
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.